Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Within a 24-hour period, there are at least 5,000 more deaths globally from COVID-19, taking the figure to more than 583,000 dead. In the U.S., there are more than 137,000 deaths from it. The number of confirmed infections is more than 13.5 million and approximately 3.5 million in the U.S. U.S. President Donald Trump is attempting to quell reports of a rift between himself and Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease specialist. Mr. Trump also looked to distance himself from an op-ed written by his trade advisor, Peter Navarro, in USA Today newspaper, in which Navarro says that he found Fauci has been wrong about everything he has interacted with him on. U.S. President Trump responded by saying that Navarro made a statement representing himself. He went on to say that Navarro should not be doing that, but the president himself has a very good relationship with Fauci. Trump's statement came as the White House is seeking to tamp down a dispute between the president and Dr. Fauci over the best way to handle the outbreak of coronavirus in the United States. As the number of positive coronavirus cases continues to rise in the United States, several states are taking action to fight the virus. Arizona, Florida, and Texas alone have been reporting about 25,000 new confirmed cases. They're on the rise in Alabama as well, and its governor, Kay Ivey, is requiring the wearing of masks now. Florida's not mandating masks, but for the first time, Governor Ron DeSantis wore one Wednesday while speaking publicly. Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt does not want to require a mask. He said, "You just open up a big can of worms. This is a personal responsibility." He rarely wears one, and Wednesday he became the first governor to say that he's tested positive for the virus. This is VOA News. Brian Kemp, the governor in the U.S. state of Georgia, is explicitly banning Georgia's cities and counties from ordering people to wear masks in public places. He's voiding orders that at least 15 local governments across the state had adopted, even though Kemp had earlier said cities and counties had no power to order masks. The Republican governor has instead been trying to encourage voluntary mask wearing. An increasing number of other states or order residents to wear masks in public, including Alabama, which announced such a ban Wednesday. Kemp's move is likely to infuriate local officials and communities that had acted, including Atlanta, Augusta, Savannah, Rome, and the governor's hometown of Athlone, Clark County. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Wednesday that the United States would impose visa restrictions on Chinese companies like Huawei Technologies, which he accused of facilitating human rights violations. Pompeo told a news conference the State Department would impose the visa restrictions on certain employees of Chinese tech companies like Huawei that prop up regimes that violate human rights. Asked about British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's order that Huawei equipment be purged from British 5G networks by the end of 2027, Pompeo said faster is always better in terms of getting Huawei out of telecom infrastructure. It's a security risk. This isn't about commercial interests, he said. It's about protecting the information, in this case, the United Kingdom's people. The United States contends Huawei is a security risk because of its links to the Chinese government. Beijing rejects the assertion, saying the United States is just trying to get rid of a commercial rival. A group of hardline Iranian politicians have reportedly abandoned an attempt to impeach President Hassan Rouhani after the country's supreme leader signaled he still backs the man. About 10 parliamentarians are said to be pushing for a home in impeachment and were trying to rally other lawmakers to the cause. The Iranian parliament has 290 seats, but one politician said the motion had been dropped after Ayatollah Khamenei, the highest authority in the country, had expressed support for the government. Rouhani has been long criticized by hardline elements in Iran and has been complicated by the rapid deterioration of relations with the U.S., starting with Washington's withdrawal from the 2015 nuclear deal. The daily struggle for Iranians to make ends meet has also become harder since the reimposition of U.S. sanctions 2 years ago, and the economy has been further damaged by rising inflation, growing unemployment, and the coronavirus crisis. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia's parliament tells Firestone to stop retrenchment of 374 employees.
Firestone has been envisaged by so many of us as an agent of extreme exploitation in Liberia, especially a company, first and foremost, that got a concession agreement for 99 years.
ECOWAS's Community Court of Justice awards a former Nigerian High Court judge 50 naira in nominal damages. Kenya and the UN launch sustainable development goals. Child malnutrition in South Africa amid COVID-19. And Zambia's main opposition party says reduction in candidate nomination fees is not enough.
The reduction is not enough. It will still act as a barrier to many people to participate in the election as candidates. We think that the cost for the election should be financed by the government through the taxpayers' money.
Charles Kakoma is spokesman for Zambia's main opposition, UPND party. And is gold from Sudan being used to finance armed groups? Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Liberian House of Representatives has told the Firestone Rubber Plantations Company not to go ahead with its decision to retrench 374 employees. Firestone was not immediately available for comment, but a spokesperson told VOA the company was in the process of preparing an official statement in response to the parliament's directive. In published local media reports, Firestone said the retrenchment was necessary to preserve its operations in Liberia. Representative Akaros Gray is a ranking member of the Committee on Investment and Concessions. He says Firestone, which has operated in Liberia for over 90 years, has failed to live up to its promises.
Firestone has been envisaged by so many of us as an agent of extreme exploitation in Liberia, especially a company, first and foremost, that got a concession agreement for 99 years and later on amended that concession agreement on an interim arrangement in 2005 for another 37 years and buying 1 million acres of land in Liberia at the price of 1 cent United States dollars per acre of land. A million acres of land. They've made a lot of money all of Liberia as far as 1926. Now they've come to the people of Liberia arguing that the price of oil has fallen in the world market. They're not making no more profit. They want to redundant our people with all any medical benefit, with all any educational benefit. And especially, we see this as a brief slap in the face of Liberians when Firestone want to redundant people on the 26th of this month, which is Liberia's Independence Day, to lay out 374 Liberians.
Representative Gray, Firestone says that the redundancy decision is necessary to preserve the operation in Liberia.
Let me say this to you, Mr. Barty. Liberia is a country governed by laws. We have what we call the decent work bill. And also in that decent work bill, we have what we call the minimum wage bill. So Firestone will have to live in conformity with the existing laws of the Republic of Liberia, especially when it comes to the decent work bill and the minimum wage bill. And also, we have to understand the full financial statement of Firestone. We have to see what the contract is, the contract they want to sign between them and another company. We have to see all of those things so Firestone cannot take a step, no matter what the situation is. They've exploited the people of Liberia. That's why when you have an entity, when you make profit, you keep some of those profit. That's why when you employ people, you have agreements with the people you employ, you cannot take unilateral decisions.
We know that Firestone employs a lot of Liberians. Some of your colleagues have said that the company has failed to live up to its promise. What promises are they talking about?
We have to first see the contract. The contract cannot be in isolation of legislative overview of the contract. So interestingly, the presenter of contract to the legislature yesterday that was not signed, they argued in front of the full plenary that they have a contract, but the lawyers advised them not to bring the signed contract, but the broader contract that was not signed. When the question was posted to them, they said, yes, it's the contract, but this is not the sign one. So we felt it was an affront to the National Legislature of the Republic of Liberia. And they have to follow our instruction. They have no choice because the law is the law and we use the law effectively.
So what do you think about the decision by the company saying that it has contracted some of its work to private firms, and because of that, it cannot afford also to meet the workers' benefits such as health and education?
The premises in terms of first and foremost better health condition of our people, better educational facility for our people, better housing unit for our people, etc. In terms of the salary structure for our people, those are critical issues. We've been on this fight for some time. So for Firestone now to give our contracts to other companies and arguing that they cannot bear full burden of health delivery, for example, educational care for our people, for example, is a breach of the initial agreement we have with the Firestone Rural Plantation.
Akaros Gray is a ranking member of the Committee on Investment and Concessions of the Liberian House of Representatives. You are speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. The Community Court of Justice of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has awarded 50 naira in nominal damages to a former judge of the Nigerian High Court. The court found that the National Judicial Council of Nigeria violated Justice Alade Tunyimbo's right to a fair hearing while he was undergoing disciplinary hearing for judicial misconduct. But Justice Dupe Atoke, who read the ECOWAS court judgment, says the court awarded the 50 naira nominal damages because Justice Alade Tunyimbo did not provide evidence of the prejudice he suffered.
The judgment of this court is premised on an application by a judge of the Federal Capital Territory in Abuja, Nigeria, alleging that his right to freedom from torture and his right to fair hearing were violated based on the fact that he was subjected to some disciplinary process following a petition that was written against him by a party to an action that he did a judgment in Abuja. And the Nigerian Judicial Council, the NJC, is the organ responsible for monitoring the behavior of judges in Nigeria. And after the investigation, the NJC found that the judge had been involved in some judicial misconduct and therefore issued him a letter of warning and put him on a 9-month judicial watch list. The court heard both parties.
Violation of fundamental rights and irregular court proceedings, or those are serious charges. Now, can you tell us the purpose of this 50 naira as the award for this ruling?
Yes, allegation of torture is very serious. It's one of the human rights that cannot even be derogated from, even at the time of emergency, war, terrorism and all. But then you must put enough facts before the court to reach a decision. The court found that he did not provide sufficient evidence to show that he had been, because the facts he alleged do not amount to torture at all. They do not. And therefore, that ground of torture was dismissed. The second ground of fair hearing, which is also a very serious violation of human rights. As an African, you must show two things. One, that the facts establish that your right has been violated. And secondly, the facts establish that you have suffered some harm or prejudice. He succeeded on the first arm of establishing that his right was violated. Now, when it comes to reparation, you must establish the first and the injury that you have suffered. If you are not able to establish that, the court is not in a position to award any substantial amount to ameliorate the injury that you have suffered.
The last time I spoke with the president of the court, Justice Asante, we discussed what I saw as the inability of the court to get its decisions enforced. Has there been any development in this area?
There's always, every day brings progress. States are beginning to deploy the authority that should enforce their judgments, which is a good point, an indication that the member states are now getting to recognize the importance of implementing. One of the provisions of the protocol is that every member state must designate an implementing authority where the ECOWAS court can deposit these judgments and can get updates on its implementation. So I think that there's some progress that is going on and some improvement in the erstwhile attitude of member states in implementing the decisions of the ECOWAS.
That was Justice Dupe Atoke of the ECOWAS Community Court of Justice. She was speaking with us from Abuja, Nigeria. Kenya's government has launched the Joint Sustainable Development Goals Fund for Social Protection. The fund, a joint program between United Nations agencies and the Kenyan government, will support Kenya to move from a poverty-targeted approach to a more inclusive approach to social protection. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, Kenya's Labor and Social Protection Cabinet Secretary Simon Chalugi said the program will receive a grant of $2 million from UN partners.
The Constitution of Kenya 2010 under the Bill of Rights Article 43 guarantees all Kenyans their economic, social and cultural rights, which binds the state to provide appropriate social security to persons who are unable to support themselves and their dependents. Speaking in Nairobi, Kenya's Labor and Social Protection Cabinet Secretary Simon Chelgui said that as Kenya develops and moves towards middle-income country status, higher investment in social protection will create stability, a more dynamic and competitive economy. Mr. Chelgui said that the government is committed to cushion vulnerable populations against poverty by spending approximately $260 million annually on social assistance programs.
As Kenya develops and moves towards middle-income country status, higher investment in social protection will create greater stability, increased prosperity, a more dynamic and competitive economy. 12% of our communities are on this program.
According to the Ministry of Labor and Social Protection, disruptions caused by COVID-19 pandemic needed the government to put systems in place to cushion all citizens against such crises so that when faced with a crisis, they are able to respond immediately and save lives. Chelgui said that despite the challenges during this time of COVID-19 crisis, the government has first rolled out interventions to cushion the vulnerable from extreme poverty through weekly earnings for lower income households.
We also appreciate your generosity for also providing $2 million for this joint program, which will be implemented through the UN system in Kenya. My ministry has reviewed the National Social Security Protection Policy of 2012 to capture issues that have emerged. The revised policy adopts a life cycle approach and its guiding principle and puts forward a nationally defined minimum for four basic social protection guarantees that shall be established by law.
According to the World Food Program, WFP, the fund has provided a new opportunity in Kenya to boost the country's vision of achieving a prosperous status by 2030 in line with the Global Sustainable Development Goals. Representing UN agencies, World Food Programme Senior Deputy Country Director Callum Gardner said that the fund, which is being established by 12 donors, seeks to unlock opportunities in Kenya and other 34 countries across the world.
The joint SDG fund has provided a new opportunity in Kenya to bolster the country's vision of achieving a prosperous status by 2030 in line with the Global Sustainable Development Agenda. The Kenya joint program will build on already existing UN support to the social protection in Kenya by strengthening social protection systems and the linkages between social protection and other sectors.
The Sustainable Development Goals Fund joint program will be implemented through the UN system under the Resident Coordinator's Office in close collaboration with the World Food Program, UNICEF, International Labour Organization, and Food and Agriculture Organization. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 16th. The COVID-19 lockdown in South Africa, the country was hit by the virus on the continent, is raising worries about children getting adequate nutrition. Malnutrition of children has long been a problem in South Africa, but measures to control the pandemic has cut off some of the vulnerable from government meals program. Frank Puglisi reports from Johannesburg.
The coronavirus lockdown has disrupted the free meals program in South Africa schools for 9 million poor children. The absence of those meals puts a lot of families in a tough spot, says director of the Teddy Bear Clinic, Dr. Shaida Omar.
With children not being able to go to school, a lot of children have been deprived of the opportunity of having access to food. During the lockdown period, what we have also found that many people have not been able to secure an income to generate any form of income. People both within the formal sector and informal sector have suffered, I think, enormously as a result of this.
The worst off are the children below school age, under age 5, who in some cases suffer from severe malnutrition and stunted growth.
Over 400,000 children in that age cohort category not having access to food. So the food insecurity, and if we just look at adequate nutrition and support of children, it's definitely a grave situation, a situation that requires urgent attention.
25 years old and unemployed, Julia Moyo struggles to provide food for her 5 stepchildren. She says, as a family, they are facing a challenge to maintain the children at the moment, since the grandmother, who was the main breadwinner, recently passed away. The father of the children is now the single breadwinner, says Moyo. But he is also helping other family members who live nearby. The United Nations World Food Programme says between 1/4 to 1/3 of South African children are stunted or too thin. Gilbert Seitauze is a nutrition specialist with the United Nations International Children's Fund in South Africa.
Children are not consuming enough food with the right nutrients that are needed for their growth. Is the immediate cause of malnutrition in children. In infants and older children, it is due to poor infant feeding practices, wherein you find that most of the children are either not breastfed. And we need to remember that the greatest burden of all forms of malnutrition is shouldered by children from the poorest and most marginalized communities.
As the pandemic persists, and more children go hungry and suffer from malnutrition, achieving the United Nations goal of zero hunger in the years to come is seriously in doubt. Frank Puklisi for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development, the UPND, says the reduction in candidate nomination fees for the 2021 general election is not enough. UPND spokesperson Charles Kakoma says the government should fund all elections and not pass the cost on to the candidates. The Electoral Commission of Zambia earlier this week reduced the nomination fee of a male presidential candidate to 95,000 kwacha or $5,000 and a female presidential candidate to 75,000 kwacha or $4,000. The fee for a male parliamentary candidate was reduced to 15,000 kwacha or $825 and for a female parliamentary candidate to 13,500 kwacha or around $742. Kakoma says the new fees would discourage women and the poor from participating in politics.
The UPND was seriously opposed to the proposed nomination fees. The first time they were announced about 2 weeks ago, they were unreasonable because the increase was more than 100% of the previous nomination fees. And we thought it was unreasonable because it was going to make it difficult for many people to participate in the election as candidates. The Electoral Commission of Zambia has since reduced the fees, but the reduction is not enough. It will still act as a barrier to many people to participate in the election as candidates. With the serious poverty levels in our country, it becomes very difficult, for example, in rural areas for a villager to find 1,000 kwacha, which is equivalent to $100. That is most very, very difficult for people that are living on less than $1 per day.
Why do you suppose there is a difference between male presidential candidates and female presidential candidates in terms of the fee?
We're talking about, for example, encouraging women to participate in the election, but a lot of these women are not financially sound. They depend, for example, on their husbands to finance their election bid. And if they go to the husband and ask for that kind of amount just for nomination fees, if the husband refuses, that will be the end of the lady's presidential ambitions or parliamentary ambitions. So we think that the cost for the election should be financed by the government through taxpayers' money. They should not shift the cost to candidates. The Electoral Commission must have known that we are going to have an election in 2021 and should have adequately budgeted for each activity, including the preparation of the application forms for candidates. They should not pass the application forms, the costs to candidates. That in our poor economic setting in Zambia is going to disadvantage a lot of people, including the women, including those that are differently abled, and also the youth. They find it very difficult to participate. So we think that these nomination fees are still prohibitive, even at this level where they've been reduced.
Charles Kirk Coleman is spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development. You're speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. International companies that are household names throughout the globe may be using gold from Sudan that was sold to help finance armed groups, according to a new report this week by Global Witness. The group says its research shows that United Arab Emirates-based Kaluti Refinery bought conflict gold from Sudan in the recent past. Global Witness researcher Alex Cobb spoke to Ricky Stryak about the details of the report.
Our report reveals that the world's largest gold refinery, which is the Swiss company Balcambi, has sourced quite significant amounts of gold from a notorious refinery, which is called Kaluti and is based in Dubai. And the report also shows that Kaluti probably bought Sudanese gold linked to armed groups in Darfur, the west of the country, in 2012, and was at high risk of doing the same in subsequent years. Kaluti's gold could also be ending up in products of major household brands such as Amazon, Starbucks, Sony, Disney, and HP.
What does these findings mean for the Sudanese themselves, that this gold is often used to finance armed groups?
There has been a long war in Sudan, and one of the longest civil wars. Still until today, there are several armed groups and paramilitary groups active and committing human rights abuses in Sudan. Several of them and several of these armed groups, they occupy mines and make money through these gold mines. There is, for example, the Sudan Liberation Army, which occupies mine in Jabal Mara area. Sudan Liberation Army has bought weapons with the money from that mines, according to the UN. There are often involved in kidnappings, torture, they use forced labor. So that is one of the really negative impacts. There are other armed groups like the Abala armed group, which has occupied the Jebel Amir mines. This is an area which is particularly rich in gold. In 2013, when they occupied the mines, they fought against another armed group over the access to the mines. That led to the death of hundreds of people. Yeah, the UN estimated, for example, that there was around 2015 that this Abala armed group, they received over $50 million through gold mining and trading. And their leader, Hilal, he has a history of human rights abuses.
While this is happening in Sudan, there is a global supply chain involved that implicates people all over the world. So can you kind of tell me about what kind of global brands are involved and how maybe someone in the U.S. or in Europe is actually unknowingly possibly contributing to this?
The refinery Kaluti in Dubai sources a lot of gold from Sudan and possibly also conflict gold. This Kaluti, which had already a bad reputation, surprisingly is dealing with Valcambi, which is the largest refinery in the world. There are a lot of companies at the end of this supply chain which receive gold through other companies or through products which contain gold. For 2018, 270 brands, international brands have reported that they might have received gold from Kaloti gold refinery, which has sourced problematic gold from Sudan. So in the end, it seems that this gold is ending up everywhere in the world.
That was Alice Cobb, a researcher with Global Witness. You're speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. And that's it for this Thursday.